following was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated in Memphis, Tennessee.
This episode from Radioland is brought to you by our friends at Wizards. Those of you here in Memphis know exactly what I'm talking about. Over there in Midtown at 1999 Madison Avenue, having a fall sale right now. Yep, you go into the store. It's only in store. It's not online. It's in store only. So get in there. Open 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. 7 days a week. Step in there. Get you some stuff. And look, they've got a 901 rock in there. And if you can find it, you get 50% off your order. Mention this ad that you heard it to the clerk, and they'll knock 20% off your sales right there at Wizards, because it's still smoking. Hello, my name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland. Greetings, salutations, hello, hey, how's it going? Welcome to another episode from Radioland. Something different this time out. You may have already heard this. We aired this in its entirety on an episode of the Booze and Blues Show. The reason being, let me kind of back this up a little bit. What you're about to hear is a conversation that was held in Studio C at Pirate Radio Studios. It was the first time we've used that room. It was big enough to handle it. What we had here, you see, was Bill Lusk, his friend Rick Malko, Willie Hall was in the studio, and our friend Steve Davis was there. And we were talking about Bill and Rick's music over the years and how they'd traveled all over the world and the foundation, the creation, if you will, of the Blues Foundation. That's how all that started. Well, there was a reason. There was an initial plan to have them live on the air, but we decided against that. The reason being, we needed to edit the interview fairly heavily. Bill, you see, is just recently been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And Willie and Rick thought it would be a great idea to at least have some of his story told in his words while he could still remember it. I know about the devastation of Alzheimer's. A member of my family suffered with it and has ultimately succumbed to it. It is a devastating, horrible disease. And I'm not going to go on too much about it, but the chance for us to sit down with Mr. Lusk and listen to his stories as told from him was a very special moment. We played the interview in its entirety at Radio Memphis there during the Booze and Blues Show, and we included some of the music that he talked about. And these were off of old 45s. That's all that survives of his music. It's a fantastic story. So we're going to present that to you here. And a special edition from Radioland.
So, where do we start, fellas?
Where's the money?
Just like a bluesman, where's the money?
Well, how far back you want to go? We could go back to where Bill and I met, which was like in a 74 or so.
Where did y'all meet?
In Tampa.
Y'all playing together in Tampa?
No, we just happened to meet, and both of us happened to be living in Tampa at the time, and we had just happened to run into each other at an open mic.
Just playing the blues in a club somewhere, and there it was, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, playing everything.
You know. Yeah.
And so the two of y'all struck up a good relationship then, and what ultimately wound up in Memphis, did you?
Actually, our agent was in Memphis, and we were coming those two different ways.
Were you touring all over the country at that time?
Initially, I mean, yeah, but we wound up going through the whole world.
Well, so, when we first started playing, we were playing country rock.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 74, 75. And then we went overseas did a couple of those DOD tours. Yeah. And they added a couple. There were three of us in the band.
Yeah.
We billed ourselves as the world's ugliest band.
Who were the three?
It was me and Bill and Fred Lord, a guy named Fred Lord from Tampa. And we pretty well lived up to the ugliest man in the world. We could at least make a shot at it.
Well, not me.
No, of course not, Bill. Not you.
Yeah, Bill was taller and better looking back then.
But Lord, what's the other guy's name?
Fred.
Yeah, Fred Lord. He was going with us all over the place too at that point.
I understand you're quite the songwriter too.
If I can get in the right, like anything, you know, if it's good going and, you know, yeah. And if there's just all stuff, things, you know.
He always had a great ear for a melody. You know, I've noticed guys that are good singers.
Yeah.
Tend to have a good.
It's a
good
phrasing thing, isn't it?
It's some kind of magical freaking thing. but he always had the voice, so he had that melody thing, and then his. But over the years, you could hear his lyrics definitely.
So it would start with lyrics, and then it would go musically from there. Is that typically how that would go, or would it be the other way around? You find your riff on a lead or something, and then build a story.
Whatever happened to happen at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it wasn't one or the other. It's just sometimes it was, like you say, they were doing one way, and then the other time it was going there. And you were coming with, we were just getting ready to getting out of, was that right, California? But we had gone out to, but that was a period where we were just jamming, going, get out there, come home and get drunk.
We were rehearsing. When we came back to town, we were rehearsing in Bill's backyard. He had a building. His dad had built this little wooden building back there.
Right.
It was maybe 10 feet by 12 feet. No air conditioning. Mm-hmm. In the summertime, and we were in there 10 to 14 hours a day, just
sweating and making rock and roll,
sweating,
right?
Sweating and working up tunes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a good work ethic, you know. Yeah, and at that time it was mainly cover stuff, and then we started adding Bill's tunes. And like I say, his tunes always had a good strong melodic hook to them.
Yeah.
And over the years it got to where his lyrics got better and better, to where he's a pretty fair songwriter now. They're good. They're all good, solid tunes. One of them is true. And tell me how much of this you remember. We were playing down on Beale Street, and this bass player came into town. We were playing with this bass player from Chicago, and he was telling us about how he was so excited about getting down to Beale Street that he got real drunk and got with this woman, and she rolled him and took everything he had. That was his.
And his bass? Did she take his bass?
I guess she did, because he wound up taking Bill's bass. You never got your bass back from that bastard, did
you? Yeah.
I won't mention the guy's name, but anyway, he told us his story, and I thought, well, that's a cool story. Well, Bill heard the story, and he took it and wrote a song, Second in Beale.
Cool song.
And it's a true, it's this guy's unfortunate true story, you know.
Should've kept my wallet, suitcase at home. She got me drunk and now they're all gone. There I stood, no place to go. No money in my pocket, had nothing to show. But I got the blues, a second in bill. A true life story, yeah, I'm telling you it's real. I left Chicago, southbound train. New Orleans or Memphis, it all seemed the same. Decision by quarter brought me down to Beale. The promises of Memphis, could it all be real? You taught me a lesson all about life, about hurting and pain, struggling no game, trying goodbye, make a grown man cry, gone in a blink of an eye. Been told. Now Field Street's my home where I hope to grow old. Playing the blues most every night. Join to join amongst the bright lights. And I got the blues. It's second in me.
Now, a lot of songwriters, I'm sure you're the same way. You write on personal experience, or do you write from others' stories that you might have heard, or is it a fanciful thing that you write from?
Both. Sometimes I just sit down and say, okay, let's do this. And I could just, I'll put a storyline down.
He starts thinking about women.
Well, that's about where it's at.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was Sun House that said, blues are about, specifically blues, is about a man and a woman and the trouble in the relationship that happens in the middle of it. Yeah. So you're certainly not immune to that.
Well, see, I didn't feel like the country thing. It just never was felt for me. And when we first started doing the Blues Foundation and the blues down there on 2nd and Beale, we started playing out there and we were just, all of a sudden, boom, everybody's coming and watching what we're doing on the street and the people that was the vendors, they were trying to get us off because they were losing money.
And this was before the revitalization of Beale, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So there was really not much down there, was there? Just a couple
of
clubs?
Actually, there was.
Yeah.
There was quite a bit down there. The old...
It just wasn't organized.
I see, yeah. Obviously, Handy Park was something a little different, but you guys were playing out there? Were you playing outside, or did you get into any of the clubs?
Oh, best I can remember... matter of fact, I'll say something about Joe. When we first started putting all this, the blues stuff here in Memphis, Joe took us up to, because there was a bunch of people, thinking about how we're going to do this, how do this. And Joe said, well, let's go up to see how they do it in
Chicago?
Yeah, yeah.
And, speaking of how you formulated the formulation of the Memphis Blues Foundation?
Yeah, yeah.
Bill and Joe started it.
And we started playing and playing around everywhere, where we get something we make money out of. But, all in all, I live now. I never expected to live this long, because I for many years I only slept two
2 hours.
Yeah, yeah. just, you know, and then if we were on the road, you know, part of the band, most of the band was sleeping, and then the others was and then, all right, you know, after about 20, 30 miles or something like that, because it, you know, you couldn't stay under, because we'd get tired. So we just kind of rotated on them.
We had to be our own designated driver.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody was drawing straws back there.
Yeah.
So what was, at that time, what was the point of putting together this Blues Foundation? What was the reasoning at that point?
Joe Saverin really had the concept. In other words, when Bill met him, Joe had this company called Sight and Sound Productions.
Right.
And I guess, as I never met his brother, Paul Saverin, but he had a blues club downtown.
Yeah, I remembered for him too. Yeah,
but he was like from Maine or somewhere, but he was really strong on promoting the blues. In other words, we had all these blues down here, but he felt like they'd never been properly promoted.
So it was a promotional arm instead of, or was it organizational? I mean, you wanted to kind of get the guys together.
The organization to promote the blues. His bottom line was that he wanted to make the blues. He wanted the blues to have its rightful place in American music, and he felt like it wasn't getting it, you know.
Sure.
And as far as I'm concerned, to a large extent, he succeeded with it. If you look at what the Blues Foundation is and all of the other blues foundations that it's spawned over the years and all the things that it's done, I think he pretty well succeeded in that too. And at the beginning, I remember, and there could have been someone else, but I don't remember. It was him and Bill doing that.
Well, I remember him taking us all. Well, you and me and a couple of other people, we went up to Nashville to talk to them about, you know, get us, how can we make this to, you know, because the country people, they already had their place in place, you know, and everything was in, you know, they brought us in and was glad to show what they had done and change me if I'm wrong, Rick, but
I wasn't involved. I was working full time back then. I was working for Steve.
Anyway, what was the promoter there?
Yeah, Joe Saverin.
Yeah, he's just passed away not too long ago.
I just heard that. I didn't know that.
Yeah. But he was pushing everybody to get this thing going, and the ones around him, like me, and
yeah, you're the one that was running the foundation, weren't you?
Oh yeah,
you ran it.
But it you know, it just, I mean, there wasn't no work to it. I mean, it just thing kind of started going, poof, 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 getting bigger and bigger.
Kind of took off on its own.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Now in, I think it was in 68, 69, there was those first blues festivals here in Memphis that were down in Overton Park at the Levitt Shell. Now, was the foundation in place by then?
I don't think it was.
No, this was.
And that was something different, wasn't it?
Right, yeah. The foundation didn't get started until early 80s.
So I'm thinking probably like of a blues society then, because they are separate organizations, the Blues Foundation and the Blues Society, right?
No, it wouldn't surprise me if there had been some kind of an organization.
Yeah,
because I think there were only like 2 years they'd had these blues festivals here, and then it died off for some unknown reason. It wasn't until just a couple of years ago we brought it back.
Well, that may have been we were about that time was when we started hitting the road and getting out and playing all over the world, literally. I think that probably,
that was prior to the Blues Foundation.
Prior to the Blues Foundation,
yeah. But everything we were playing sounded bluesy.
Everything you sing sounds bluesy, that's for sure. You and Sharon, whatever you sing, it sounds bluesy.
Yeah.
Well, something we ought to mention, one of the things that they used to promote that And it wasn't always at the Peabody, but the night that I sat in, it was at the Peabody. They called it the Blues Midnight Rambles.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Blues Rambles. And they'd have a good blues band. It was Don McMinn's gig, usually. Yeah, this was like a revival of those original, because they,
I got
that's
you.
Where they got, that's where they got the name Blues Rambles.
Yeah.
That was a preceding thing.
Yeah, I got you.
But so they kind of revived that and
it probably put it in the ground floor of the Peabody there in the bar, wouldn't it?
Yeah. No, it was not in the. I don't remember exactly where it was, in one of their rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't recall it. It seems like sometimes it was at the New Daisy too, or I mean the old Daisy. I think it. Yeah, it would have been the old Daisy. Yeah. I think it was there sometimes too.
Right, right.
It wasn't something that I attended. Back in those days, I was working full time and I was playing in bands, mainly down in Mississippi. So
trying to make a living, you know.
Yeah.
So it's still the same thing.
I was doing that too. I mean, we both of us had jobs in there, and then we'd get off, and next thing you know, here we are out playing all night.
Imagine that. Yeah.
And, you know, literally.
Did you ever do that, Willie? Go out and play all night?
Seven days a week, and we sleep about maybe two hours, and that was for years and years. Even after we got off the road, I couldn't, you know, it was just put together, and it's hard to keep getting it.
You know, the Horseshoe Casino, they're notorious for that. I think you got six shows on Saturday if you do that weekly thing at the Horseshoe. I think they have six shows on the weekend. Six shows.
Damn.
Jesus Christ. They're short. They're like 45-minute shows, but man.
They add up, man. Yeah.
You never want to get up that fifth time. I've never gotten up for a fifth set that I wanted to play.
Not to mention the sixth that still had to happen behind that. Yeah.
The Apollo Theater back in the day, they were like that. You'd have eight and nine shows on the weekends.
Yeah.
Wow.
You're one act, so you're only doing maybe like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But you had six shows to do.
Oh, man.
On the weekend.
A lot of hurry up and wait.
Man,
God, I can remember that.
All the dressing rooms are upstairs.
Yeah.
At the corner of Winchester and Lamar was that big complex out there. Was a place called the Underground.
It used to be the Clearpool.
Yeah. That's that was ran at the time we were there. It was an after hours bar. All the strippers would get off and they'd come in, and it was like from 11 till 5 in the morning till something like that. Oh, man.
Hey, just one thing. We don't tell them all the women that we were doing during that time.
Mm. Oh, it's just assumed at this point, Bill. Yeah, it's what's the old adage? It's not so much the years, but the mileage, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. And in that point, we were just going 24 hours a day, because we would be going on the road, and we'd get a gig, and then it was, you know, okay, you go and you sleep, and we'll sleep, and we just rotated, and it was like that for years, wasn't it?
So
kept our driving chops up.
Yeah.
Did you play at the North Pole with Bill in that gig?
Close enough to the North Pole. We played at Thule, Greenland.
I know of Thule. There was an American Air Force Base there.
That's where we played.
At the Air Force Base in Thule,
Yeah, that was...
You went to Bahrain?
Yeah, we played in Bahrain, too.
Yeah.
Now, that Thule gig was in March, I think, so it was starting to get light a few hours a day.
Right.
But prior to that, it was dark all the time up there. A girl behind every tree, they said.
There's no trees.
No trees. They fell for it.
Hell yeah, we're going to Thule, y'all.
When we went up to the North Pole, God, it's just so beautiful. You cannot imagine.
Did you see Northern Lights?
Yeah.
In that time of year?
Yeah.
I got pictures of Bill up there. with this, yeah, with your, they issued us a parka,
yeah,
and a pair of mukluks.
Uh huh.
When we got
uh-huh.
there, and Bill loved his mukluks. He always, we didn't, most of us didn't wear them, but Bill wore his mukluks all the time. And I got pictures of Bill with his mukluks and his parka on.
Yeah, he said something about you had to be escorted at night.
Yeah.
Well,
it wasn't even that. It was, I mean, just because, again, it'd be 24 hours wait, you know, for a while, and then it would move and move. But, yeah, it, you didn't get away from that. And they had escorts to move us from one building to the other.
Because it was too cold to walk. They told us when we got there, so
yeah,
do, you could, it's next door, do not walk.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You, I mean, you could go 20, not even that much. And you could be dead from the
cold, yeah.
The cold and the ice.
And they had to plug in the vehicles,
right?
Kind of like a hitching post.
Yeah.
When you came in, when you pulled the vehicle in, then you would plug in. You'd have a heater under your in your oil pan, and you'd plug it into the hitching post, so it didn't freeze overnight.
Yeah, because the oil would freeze. It turned to peanut butter under there. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Even just while you were eating,
yeah,
not necessarily overnight. While you were eating, you'd have to plug that thing in.
That is cold. That is, and y'all were out there playing in it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh,
that was an indoor game.
Well, thankfully,
they
were nice enough to let you inside on that deal.
Close the patio.
Close the patio. There's no patio service tonight, fellas.
And Joe was pushing us on everything as far as getting money out there.
Or was it just three of you that traveled?
No, there were three of us in the regular band, but to go on this DOD tour, they added two young ladies to go with us.
Wow.
To make us more palatable to the
troops.
To the troops, yeah.
Well, yeah, you put a broad out there on the stage, yeah.
They two broads.
Two broads, yeah.
And
you
both
know.
Of them good looking.
Well, of course.
Well, they wouldn't have put in ugly broads.
Well, I don't know. Some of them might have been.
Defeat the purpose,
or else maybe it was me.
There weren't no ugly broads up in Thule.
There were hardly any up there from what you're telling me, Rick.
They said they weren't ugly.
They couldn't.
But the only thing I had going for it was the coldest beer in the world, I'd think.
Yeah.
Here, walk this outside for 5 minutes and let's cool it off.
That's where we discovered Jägermeister. You remember that?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Those Danes, you talk about people that could drink, those Danes could put it away.
Well, if you're living like that, what else are you going to do, you know?
Yeah.
Can't chase women.
Yeah, I can't chase women.
I'm just now starting to get back into that routine. But, on the whiskey.
Where else did you guys play?
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That wasn't nearly as much fun.
I wouldn't think so. They probably frowned on the two broads on stage, you know.
Yeah.
Well, these were military bases, too.
And they were good-looking women, too.
But it was like you couldn't drink, you know.
You couldn't drink, yeah.
You couldn't drink. And, I mean, they had it in the BOQ, you know. They'd have liquor in there, but
And in certain times, we just didn't have enough women, and next thing you know, hell, we were having to put on socks and all kinds of stuff to get them out there.
You tripping?
He remembers it well.
No, you got to understand.
No, I really not, Bill.
We played England and Germany.
Way to change the subject, Rick.
Germany, where else to play?
did you ever play over in Japan or in Asia? Yeah?
No, uh-uh.
No, you never got to the Far East then.
I've never been over there.
And probably won't ever.
No. Yeah, by 1976, I had enough of flying.
Yeah,
you know, I had been in enough airports, and it did, and I have no desire to ever fly.
So they flew you commercially; they didn't fly you on a military plane.
They flew. No, we flew commercially. No, we mainly flew what they called military airlift command MAC flights.
Right.
It was like C-130s and C-141s.
Yeah.
And yeah. they would drive in. I remember this too. They would come in, and they would, while they were getting out, they were pulling us in, and they somewhere there, I can't explain it, but those units coming in all in time, and then they would have us getting ready. So we would get ready for the next getting out of there. And they had these Muckalucks and all kinds of gear that you wouldn't imagine.
Yeah, they're unloading missiles and,
yeah.
And stuff like that, and then they're loading up the steel guitar.
So yeah, y'all actually flew military aircraft. That had,
you're riding with the gear, yeah.
Yeah,
that's pretty...
Well, so no, was this like a USO thing? Is that how y'all?
It's Department of Defense, but it's the same kind of a deal.
I got you. So you were there to obviously entertain the troops, yeah. But there was a right. certain tour that you guys would take
our
on this.
Our agent, was that
Ken Briggsy? Ken Briggsy was that guy's okay. name.
While they would when they would get in on the as far as the getting in on it'd be. They would stop in, and then while we were moving in and out, not you know they would be going in and out supplies all the time, and we would do I don't know how many places that we.
And Bill lost his favorite hat.
Yeah.
On the train to Paris, they took the train to Paris. During a long weekend when we had a few days off, we were in Heidelberg, I think.
Yeah,
and we had a few days off, so they went to.
You ain't talking about Paris. This one, are you?
No.
Oh, okay.
How long were y'all over there? How long did your tours last?
6 or 8 weeks, something.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a substantial bit of time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we or if my memory, we lent down in Berlin, and we at that point, how long did we stay there? What in Berlin?
A couple of weeks. No, it was maybe a week. There's an interesting story about that because back then it was West Berlin.
Yeah, the wall was up. Yeah,
and you had to take the train.
Yeah.
From Frankfurt. To Berlin, and you'd go through part of East Germany. And when you would go through this part of East Germany, you had to keep the shades down, or you weren't allowed to open the shades on the train. And these
they didn't want you seeing what was going on out there.
No, these humorless East German soldiers would get on the train at whenever you'd cross one of their border things or whatever, and it was a little bit spooky, you know, and they're carrying machine guns and it was a little bit spooky, and like say they no sense of humor, those guys.
Well, no,
and but then Berlin itself was just a really cool place. The underground, the subways and stuff.
Sure, sure.
Just a cool place. Yeah.
Yeah, and the people there, they're pretty adept to the culture of the music you guys were playing too, weren't they?
Oh man, yeah. Well,
I mean, I'm talking about the native Germans. You know, I know the soldiers would be, but the Germans themselves, they would be hip to American music pretty well.
The Germans and the Italians.
Oh yeah,
and they would sing along. They could sing along with the songs. They'd know the Cat Stevens songs, and they'd sing along phonetically. They didn't know.
You didn't know what they were singing, but
no, but they knew the songs. Yeah, and they were cool. And they kind of surprised me too. I kind of thought that the Germans were going to be kind of standoffish, and they were very friendly people. It was the Scots, and you know,
it's always the Scots.
The Scots, man, and the Germans were much easier to understand. The Scots, it's like the Germans were at least trying to make you understand them. The
right.
Scots were trying to make you not understand them.
Oh. Scott.
Now, what about your time in the studio? You've spent a lot of time in recording studios and making records, obviously. I mean, that's a different experience than being up on stage.
I'll tell you, too, Joe Saverin comes up. He pushed us to do that, too. There was another, I can't remember who it is now. But anyway, we had two or three people pushing us. Hmm. And my records, what I think I am pleased, once we got back on the street and everything, you know, here and there, I think that's where a lot of the blues stuff started coming out in the initial the blues societies and every stuff.
Well, what studio did you record in, Bill?
That one over on Rainer Street that's had 12 different names.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Sounds of Memphis.
Yeah, and God, which is
Kiva.
Kiva Studios.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that was Chips wasn't a part of that one at all, was he? He was over at American at that time.
American.
Yeah.
Although I did some stuff at that time, trying to pitch in some song stuff to.
What was the two song titles, Rick, y'all did it at the Sounds of Memphis? Straight and Narrow Line
and
that's
great
the
songs.
Yeah, I'll think of the other one in a minute. Lanny McMillan arranged the horns for that one. It's kind of cool.
It's a cool song.
No one else could have gotten inside the way your loving got to me. And this feeling just can't be denied. We go together like a lock and key. I'm heading straight for you on the street in Caroline. I'm heading straight for you on the street in Caroline.
That was that Paul Zaleski guy, the guy that produced it.
Great.
It was like the song kind of got held up. You know, it was like, how are we going to do this? And Zaleski just went over there to the piano and started playing it.
Cool.
And that was it, you know.
It just kind of fell together,
You hear it against those vocals, and that was the right thing, you know.
Yeah, Bill's vocals are they're amazing.
Yeah, and that was just one of those things that just like the old lightning in a bottle, it just happened. And or was it like a multiple take thing? How many takes did y'all do on that? Do you remember?
Not many. We were thrashing around, you know, trying to get something that was going to work on it. Because he wrote it on the guitar, you know, and he could sit down and strum it on the guitar and sing it and make it believable, but it just wasn't right for the record doing it that way.
Yeah.
But when Zaleski got on that piano, that was
man, it's a killer song.
That did it. Yeah, yeah. It's got that, and that one doesn't have a lot of lyrics or anything, but the melodic hook on it is.
It's very Memphis then. Yeah.
And the mix is just whoever mixed it did a great job. It's a good song.
That straight and narrow line was a funk thing.
What year was that done?
That would have been in the early 80s. I'm not sure which. Would have been early 80s.
Right.
Or maybe 82, something like that.
The deal on it, if I remember right, it wasn't so much about the stuff that we were doing. We was trying to get gigs more than anything. And whatever we could get sold, that's fine. But the bread and money was coming in on gigs.
Playing shows. And then you'd obviously sell some of the records at the show then.
Yeah. The only thing I can think of that
Edith Head.
Yeah. She kind of did all of our pushing. And then Joe Saverin was the one that was getting all the gigs, what I remember.
Well, see, now I just remember Edith as being his girlfriend. I don't even remember.
Right.
I wasn't involved enough for the...
Oh, Edith, yeah. Duh.
That's what the Beatles said about her. Yeah.
That says it all.
And she's still around, too.
Yeah.
I just found that out here.
Here in Memphis?
Yeah.
Have you thought about playing anymore, writing anymore?
I would be more comfortable writing if it's good, not this. I don't. That's crap. I'm sorry.
I feel you.
How you really feel, Bill?
Well, they don't want me to go back there and prep on their place back there.
Well, I mean,
just expression.
Are there times where thoughts come into your head thinking that this might make a good song and you make a note of it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always coming to you?
Well, yeah. And that was, in fact, all my songs. It was just come from here.
Yeah, from the
heart. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to have a...
Yeah, we're going to write a little shuffle thing here and go with it.
Yeah. Stuff that happened.
Yeah.
We've been trying to get him motivated to pick his guitar back up, and there's no reason he can't write just as good a song as now.
Well, sure. That's just it. Yeah.
He has not been motivated, so... We've been trying to motivate his butt.
Well, I did get the guitar out now.
Well, and he's got you to motivate him, too, Rick.
Yeah, I hadn't been doing good at that. I kept my chops up, though.
Yeah.
So, are you still playing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not playing out. I've gotten too grumpy to play out. I don't give a damn if you want to hear Elvira.
Yeah, exactly. Go shove it up your butt. But you're doing some session work with Steve then, too, right?
He needs to be working, man.
I prefer to work at home. I do most of my recording at home.
Right.
In my studio.
In your studio?
Yeah.
And his whiskey.
Yeah.
Or was that me?
It could be both of you is what it sounds like.
But if you need any flute or some slippy tone,
I'll play just about anything.
Well, that's good to know. That's real good.
Hopefully, for too long, I'll have to need y'all.
Well, maybe we can help you out.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting to where I'm. Well, I can get it pretty damn good now.
Well, that just takes a little time to build that back up. Yeah,
that's why I say the motivation. When he gets motivated to pick up that guitar every day,
sure,
then he'll be back into it.
Yeah,
man, I've worked with a lot of people.
Yeah,
I've been playing for half a century, man. I've never worked with a better singer. He's got some kind of...
Amen.
Yeah.
He's got some kind of... He's got like several different kinds of... You know, there's a vibrato where you vary your pitch a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's a vibrato where you vary the amplitude a little bit. And he just naturally mixes those together and just gets the sweetest sound.
And you can hear all that on those records.
Yes, yeah. You'll hear it on the records. It's just
a great vocal.
Yeah, yeah. You'll be impressed with that.
What's coming up on the next episode from Radio Land with Rick Cheddar.
Yeah, so caught with my pants down, if you will. You know, I spent, the better part of the week doing different things and didn't do a podcast. Because, as you know, hello, secret, we do this a week in advance, not this time out. So next week you're going to hear something completely new and fresh and fun and wild. But I can tell you this, next week you'll also hear music from Deering and Down. Yeah, buddy, that's going to be a lot of fun. So you can find that. Do me a favor, share this show with everybody you know in social media. If you happen to listen to this on iTunes, go to the iTunes page and write a nice comment. That would be nice. That'd be really sweet if you would do that. If you would check it out and share it with everybody you know, and there is that. Also, make sure that you share it amongst your friends on social media. That's a good thing, too. So all that, if you would, please, in the meantime, and we'll see you next week right here from Radioland.
For previous episodes, go to radio-memphis.com. To download episodes to your mobile device, search the show in iTunes, player.fm, stitcher.com, Pocket Cast, or TuneIn. And now, here's more with Rick Cheddar from Radioland.
You know, you can play guitar. You can do so quite simply from the comfort of your own home. Learn online. It's a cool thing. Check out the New York City Guitar School. Their banner ads at our website at radio-memphis.com. Click on that, and you can get some guitar lessons in the privacy of your own home when you have time to take those lessons. Not being on a schedule or anything like that, going to a music teacher and all that other fun stuff. And it's real reasonable, too. Plus, right now, there's a free video up there that can show you if this thing is even right for you. So check it out. Look for the Guitar Lessons app, or the ad, I should say, at radio-memphis.com. Click on it and take a look around there and get signed up. It'll be good. You can learn to play the guitar. You'll get laid. I can promise you that. All right, kids. There is that. One more note here about our interview with Bill and Rick and Willie and Steve. First of all, my thanks to those gentlemen for doing so, and our deepest thanks to Mr. Mark Caldwell for making all that happen. It was a very special moment that we got to share. When we aired it, Bill and Willie came down to the studio to listen to it, and they heard it broadcast live, and it was actually quite nice. To give you an idea about Alzheimer's and what seems sort of cute is really not, because it's a disease. I've met Bill 3 or 4 times now, and he introduces himself to me as though I were a complete stranger each and every time. That's the thing about Alzheimer's. It's brutal. I mentioned earlier at the top of the show that I had a family member that suffered with it. It was my brother-in-law, my sister's husband. He had it at a very young age, and it was a very long, hard fought battle to manage it. My family did so, they at great expense to them, and time and effort and worry and emotion. That's what happens with Alzheimer's. It's not necessarily the individual who has it that is aware of what's going on, because he's not. But it's the depth of the damage that is done around the family. It's a horrifying and horrible disease. If you want to learn more, you can find more on the American Alzheimer's Association. And here in Memphis, there's groups that really are quite supportive and quite helpful, like the Paige Robbins group and stuff like that. Look for if you have a family member that has it, you understand it. You know exactly what I'm talking about, but you can't go through it alone. Look online and find the neighborhood group that is there for you. There's in just about every major city, there is a support group that will help you out. I highly recommend it. It'll help save your own peace of mind. So there, not to end on a downer, but sometimes that's how it goes. So there, we'll see you next time. Next week, you already heard that, which was really nothing but a weird little promo. Never done that before, too. So sort of an episode of first. But nevertheless, we'll see you next time. Y'all take care of yourselves and take care of one another, will you? And for God's sake, quit shooting yourselves and everybody else. Just stop it. I'm Rick Cheddar, and this has been From Radioland.
Rick Cheddar from Radioland is produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. All music performed during this episode was used by permission. No part of this program can be rebroadcast or used in any other way except by written consent. For bookings and other inquiries, you can write the show by sending an email to radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. For more, go to radio-memphis.com.